welcome again to the St. David's Summer Reading Project podcast. This is Remington.
And this is Rebecca.
We are glad to be back with you as we take our second look at the 2006 book from Daniel Levitin, This Is Your Brain on Music.
So Remington, I feel like the second half of this book, I have come full circle from our first book, Dune. We have moved from sandworms officially to earworms, and I am not making a Star Trek reference here. And so just so everybody knows, Remington did not know that Star Trek reference, and I had to explain it to him. And if you were born in the 80s and experienced the trauma that was the earworm in Star Trek, just know that that is not what I'm referring to.
We could have a whole segment on trauma from movies that show things going into people's ears, probably.
Yes.
Let's avoid that. I think we should not have that segment.
I would like just to talk about music. Thank
you. Yeah, let's do that. Let's do that. So a lot of great material in the second half of the book. Hopefully the readers who are alongside us have had a chance to finish the book and take a look at some of the really great concepts there. As we noted in the kind of pre-show conversation, some of Levitin's humor and some good storytelling comes out in the second half of the book alongside some really great concepts for understanding music, the way music affects our mood and our brain, how musicians function in this world. There's so much good material there. Let's maybe just jump in with some of your favorite parts, Rebecca. What did you notice as you read the last half of the book?
Oh, wow. One of the concepts that I loved in this book is the concept of a sonic landscape. Mm-hmm. I, first of all, thought that was just beautiful. And Levitin on page 156 says, some songs simply have an overall sound, and he also describes it as a sonic color. And I think that is exactly the way some music makes me feel. It's just like you go in, you hit the groove, because he talks about the groove also, and you enter into a world, an auditory world that you don't want to leave.
Right. I love that. In that phrase, sonic landscape or soundscape, he's combining all these different elements into kind of one concept so that we can understand not only how one genre sounds or another genre sounds and what might be prototypical for the genre, which he talks more and more about, but also how someone else can mimic that and play on our emotional connection to a particular soundscape. I think that's great. He noted in particular the way that Eric Idle and Monty Python could mimic the Beatles by developing the same soundscape, mm-hmm. but using it for satirical purposes. And it's a really great way, I think, of making some of these concepts accessible for people who don't maybe know a lot about music, or for whom the first couple chapters of this book were so dense in their description of mm-hmm. all the different qualities of music that we can now just refer to soundscape and probably be close enough to being done with mm-hmm. a lot of that other stuff.
And I also love, like, if you think about how certain eras of music have defined music in general, how many times have, you know, an artist do a 50s doo-wop style album? Mm-hmm. Like Billy Joel did it. Elvis Costello definitely had that mm-hmm. soundscape going on for some of his music. And I think it's really interesting how you can also take a soundscape and play with it and make it something else too.
Right. I mean, it mirrors visual arts and other arts as well. Mm-hmm. And he makes good note of the parallels between different artistic styles in different media. But the notion that somebody can play on or play with an element from another genre. And I read an article recently that I thought was interesting related to this, the way that Baroque art is surging in popularity as a backdrop for memes on TikTok and Instagram.
not
because anybody actually appreciates the Baroque art behind it, but instead because there's something visually appealing that they're riffing on. And that's just kind of working for Gen Z right now.
Well, I will be at the National Gallery of Art next week. I will see if I can take This Is Your Brain on Music and make some good memes.
There you go. So I think one of the things that is enjoyable for me, and we talked about it some with Julia last week, is the genre bending that happens between different pieces of music. When one artist in 2022 mimics the synthesizer sounds of the 1980s or something in new music, I end up loving that. Or if somebody calls to mind phrases or soundscape from another genre in an effort to try to move me to a particular place with their music, I sometimes like that more mm-hmm. than I do what is expected from a genre. I think the concept there is fascinating, that we have our expectations. Mm-hmm. We know what heavy metal is supposed to sound like. And when there is something that bends us from that, we have the potential to really enjoy it. We might reject it. Sometimes mm-hmm. it goes too far for us. But often, that's a really enjoyable and pleasurable experience.
Yeah. Well, there's a part in the book where Levitin talks about our brains and how our brains can recognize a song. And I'll put it in the show notes, but there is a tribute, Metallica tribute album where like Weezer covers Nothing Else Matters. Chris Stapleton has an amazing version of the song. Miley Cyrus does one of the songs. I mean, it's a crazy album, but my brain immediately knew it was Metallica, even though mm-hmm. it sounded completely different. It didn't have any of the soundscape of heavy rock.
Right.
But you knew what it was immediately. But the fact that computers have not yet quite, well, of course, as we were saying too, this book was written in 2006. The computers may have caught up to this a little bit better since he wrote this. But that computers were struggling to have the same type of phrasing and memory.
Understanding the relationship between yep. the different parts, right? Our brain has an incredible capacity to recognize the patterns in relationship to one another and to be able to say, oh yeah, that's still Metallica, even though it's coming out with a kind of country style. Mm-hmm. I still know the elements, the constituent elements of this particular song. Maybe it's pitch, relative pitch anyway. Maybe it's the rhythm. Maybe it's the interval between one pitch and the next. You know what that arpeggio sounds like when Nothing Else Matters starts. Mm-hmm. And as soon as you can connect to that, you kind of know what's going to come next. And Stapleton, for instance, would continue to mess with you mm-hmm. Through the rest of the song. But
it was great.
Yeah, right. That's surprise yeah. in a really pleasurable way. It's suspense and surprise in a really pleasurable way. But also really incredible that our brain has the capacity to hold on to that and to store that information in such a way that it becomes accessible for us. You noted just a moment ago that Levitin wrote this book in 2006, and so maybe computers have caught up. They haven't finished catching up with us, but yeah, computers can do a lot of this now. The way machine learning and artificial intelligence works now, the capacity of a software program to access a relational database and pick up all of that complexity and understand relationships between one thing and another, computers can often then output to us the same output that our brain is trying to work mm-hmm. with. One of the things we talked about pre-show is that on Instagram right now, frequently one can find people who've programmed bots, which are computer programs, to listen to like the entire discography of Taylor Swift for, you know, thousands of hours, and then reproduce a new Taylor Swift song. And the bots can do it with pretty incredible accuracy. New song, but she has patterns mm-hmm. that she utilizes from timbre to word selection. And those bots can see those patterns better than humans often can and are consciously aware, not consciously like your worst sci-fi nightmares, but are aware. They are aware of what those patterns are and then can spit them back out at us.
So as we were doing the research on our own brains and how our brains process music, did that research help form the computer science of the artificial intelligence, how to find those connections?
Levitin points to this a number of times in the book in ways that don't go deeply enough down that hole, but we knew more about computer science, and then the question was really, do our brains work like computers do? Over time, I think that computers are structurally becoming more and more complex. And when we say computers, really we mean software. Structurally more and more complex. I don't think that they're trying to mimic the architecture of the brain, because I think we know much more about computers than we do about the architecture of the brain. And so they're constantly trying to crack that code on what would allow for this particular program to scan through all of these different components and draw forward something that seems human. In popular news right now, and there is the employee from Google who thought he was doing whistleblowing because he thought he had sentient AI on his hands because that program had so perfectly accessed a database of words in relationship to one another and human speech patterns that it knew how to give him what he was asking for. And the primary way in which it had done that was reading Twitter for like the last 10 years.
Well, if you figure he had done his 10,000 hours and now he was the master of manipulator.
That's right. That's right. As, expertise.
Know, Twitter has strived to become. So it's interesting that we're talking about computers because we were also talking about the rise of software and click tracks in music. And when we were actually talking about what makes a musician, the chapter that talks about the art. And one thing that we all kind of agree is that some artists, with their imperfections, is what makes it truly art. Their right. idiosyncrasies, their, like, they had a, he had a great description where he said Stevie Wonder's could play the drums and the breathing of the drums. I'd never heard that phrase before, but I was like, that's an amazing concept.
Right, right. And he talked about Horowitz playing the piano and making mistakes on recordings, but that's what makes it art. I love that. I, as a person who's been interested in music production for a while, I certainly have noticed since the writing of this book, the accessibility of software for music production. It's so widespread now that often it comes just natively on people's computers when they
like
buy.
Like GarageBand.
Exactly. GarageBand is the classic example, often just already on your Mac when you get a Mac. And so a teenager can create music electronically without playing a single instrument just by getting their actually GarageBand comes on phones, I think, now as well, or iPads. And so there's been a real change in the way that production has happened. Utilizing click tracks for live music in particular and for studio sessions as well. But then in the software program, you can align what we would call the transients. The waveform will have little spikes when a snare drum hits or something like that. You can align that perfectly to a grid, and that grid can be exactly 120 beats a minute. And then there is a perfect tightness, so to speak. Something might be rushed from the performer or a little bit relaxed from the performer. Both of those are going to get shrunk into exactly perfectly on grid, 120 beats a minute. And some people find that really pleasing. I tend not to. I like very tight music. I like to listen to musicians who are in the pocket and are really connected to a groove. But if it's perfect, it drives me a little bit crazy. Unless I'm looking for that. Like sometimes I'm looking for that in particular, but most of the time I prefer live music over studio music for the same reason. I wanna hear the imperfections. I wanna see the improvisation happening, not only listening to it, but seeing the way that the musicians respond to each other as they're improvising. It's a much richer experience for me.
And I think it's really interesting that he also makes a comment that you can be a classically trained musician and be so perfect, but not have any soul.
Yeah, yeah.
And as somebody who's had a lot of voice training, and I know that I don't have a lot of expression. I'm a great choir singer. I am perfect for a choir, not great as a soloist. But I also accept that as my shortcoming. I have a voice that blends well with others. But it's really interesting because it also talks about we all have musical brains. We all have the aptitude to appreciate and understand music. And this is a conversation we had last week where the perfection is actually gotten so hard as consumers that we're less likely to participate.
To even participate, right.
And yet the imperfections is what we're both saying is kind of what makes it real.
Yeah.
And emotional.
Right. In our conversation pre-show about computer software generating music, we kind of talked about the parallel between that development of expertise, the 10,000 hour paradigm, and the way that software can develop expertise as well, but that I can spend my 10,000 hours playing only Beethoven. That doesn't make me Beethoven. That there is something different about the quality of the artist creating from the raw material. And I can mimic that style, and I can have great expertise in mimicking that style. And I might be able to carry expertise enough to be creative in another way. Mm-hmm. But if I had done 10,000 hours of Beethoven training all the way up to the 8th symphony, that does not mean I would create the 9th symphony. And a computer, I think, same kind of thing. It can study and study and study all at once and spit something out, but it's not the same, in my opinion anyway, it's not the same as the artist doing the same. It can fool me.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's an important thing for us to acknowledge. It can fool me, it can manipulate me, and I can still appreciate what it's doing, but I can value the other thing as a different order of thing. I think one of the interesting examples that comes out of the book about the way in which a lot of this stuff has been held in popular music was the piece on Joni Mitchell and how she did not have the capacity or ability to even read music. And as a result, she created things that other musicians were often not looking for. So in this particular section, and I don't have it marked in my book, so it would be hard for me to go to it. But in this particular section, he talks about the way that Joni Mitchell was playing with session musicians, bass players in particular, who were coming in and asking her for the root note, and that she would play chords that are ambiguous. And I could say more about that, but it wouldn't be much different than what he says. A lot of chords end up being inversions, and the same three notes could be used by another chord, especially true of jazz chords and whatnot. And so what do you call it and what is the root? Sometimes that's more ambiguous than other times. And so she didn't know, but her not knowing was also what gave her the freedom to create something that is distinctly Joni Mitchell and so beautiful.
Right. It's actually on page 215, and this is what the quote is. Joni said, is that he instinctively knew to wander around the possibility space, reinforcing the different chord interpretations with equal emphasis, sublimely holding the ambiguity in a delicate suspended balance. And so this is referring to her bassist that she ended up working with the longest.
Oh, Jaco Pastorius. Yep. Yeah, one of the greatest bassists who has ever lived. Yep. Yes.
And apparently he was also very grumpy,
yeah,
very cantankerous, and she accepted that because he saw instinctively where to go with the music, and they fed off each other in ways. But what a beautiful, beautiful thought to wander around the possibility space.
Yeah, yeah. The great jazz musicians that I've known in my life, and by the way, I love the way that he says there's a big difference between expertise and celebrity. I've known some phenomenal musicians who aren't famous. Mm-hmm. The best ones that I've known have done exactly that. They are delighted by the possibility, and they would rather play in that sandbox than try to go note for note. And it's not that they couldn't go note for note in a reproduction of a Dire Straits album. That's not the point. It's boring to them. They would much rather follow the emotional expression of art in that space.
Actually, I think Paul Simon, there's actually a quote in here from Paul Simon. He's like, I've worked with some of the greatest musicians in the world and nobody knows who they are.
Nobody knows who they are. That's right. I'm pretty sure it's Jaco Pastorius, and I would have to go back and check this. He could play very fast.
Mm.
And I think, if I remember the story correctly, he used to keep a Kentucky Fried Chicken drumstick in his guitar case. And before shows, he would rub his fingers on the drumstick and get the grease from the fried chicken on his fingers so that he could slide up and down the strings better.
There's got to be something that's more sanitary that would do the same
Absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But you know what? And then you sit there and say, you know, it's what he knew.
Genius is genius.
Genius is genius.
With it.
Tell you what, not shaking his hand. I don't know how long that drumstick's been in your guitar case, but okay. That is a crazy story.
It's pretty cool.
I actually want that to be true.
I'm pretty certain.
I want that to be true. Something else that it was actually in an earlier chapter that I want to go back to is Remington and I have very different feelings about the chapter with this. I was still four seats down from Crick after dessert. I thought it was rather funny because it's a whole lot of pages for the last line. when Crick is walking away and says, look at the connections, which is basically, you know, what music is to me is connections. You know, in the context of this conversation, you know, we are looking at these information from a Christianity perspective, you know, the connections to worship and the connections to God and our community. But just the science behind the connections that music creates within the brain, and that it's based off of redundancy and distribution of functions throughout the brain, so that no matter what happens, you'll lose speech and you'll lose other memories, but one of the last things you'll probably lose is the music that came from your formative years, because it actually employs so many different areas of your brain. I find that just to be fascinating, and just what a universal human experience music is.
Yeah, yeah. And that really segues toward the chapter on the development of our capacity to appreciate music or create music as an evolutionary story. Real quick, for the record, the reason I didn't like that is because I'm pretty convinced that the publishers just told Levitin that the book needed to be longer. So much of that exposition about the dinner with Francis Crick was irrelevant to the bigger story. And so I was just trying to get through it to get to the point. But that last line, that last whole paragraph really, it does make the point that that is what this book is about, mm-hmm. and that is what our experience of music is about. It's about connection. We named a moment ago, one of those connections is our sort of emotional response to music, yep. and the way that that is attached to memory and our formative memories, as well as in our formative experience, our learning. Both of us have had, I think, similar experiences in that. We had music around mm-hmm. as children. We talked in the last episode about the way in which that is attached to music. But it's also a really important concept as it relates to church. If we're going to draw that connection back, our music is more than just an expression of our worship. Though it is that also, it is a tool by which we are developing memory, creating mm-hmm. formative experiences mm-hmm. of the text that we are singing. People can often recite all the lines of a popular hymn, mm-hmm. and they won't know the first thing about chapter and verse in a Bible story. Mm-hmm. An example of this to me is most people can, in the Episcopal tradition, give me all the lines of Seek Ye First the Kingdom of God.
I know I can.
But if I ask them to quote from the Gospel of Matthew, no chance they're getting the quotation right. But if they sing it in the back of their head, they can give me the line.
I don't think I knew it was from the Gospel of Matthew.
Case in point.
Case in point, Rebecca Klein right here. Well, and I was telling Remington a story a while ago of, and this is actually kind of a cute story. So my girls were, of course, exposed to a lot of music, and they were exposed to church music as they, you know, we went to church as they were children. And during COVID, when we had started to record and edit the services, I have a video of it. Annika was editing our Easter service, and Corinna was laying on the floor next to her with her legs at the wall playing a Game Boy, and they were singing the Agnus Dei, and they knew every word. And it was just such a, one of those things that as a mother, you're walking through the house and you're looking at this very domestic scene, and it reinforces to me, and the reason why I raised my children in the church is there are things that they can fall back on when faced with challenges that will be so ingrained into their brain, either through hymns or through the repetitive prayers. Both my girls can also recite the prayer of humble access from memory. It gives them that foundation. And I think music is such a big part of it.
Yeah. For what it's worth, there's a certain cadence to saying those prayers in community as well. And there's a certain tone that we take. There's a musicality mm-hmm. to liturgical prayer that I think allows it to be formational as well. It's not merely rote learning. Sometimes it is. And that's often a criticism of traditions like ours. But often there's a musicality to the way in which we pray mm-hmm. that allows something like the Prayer of Humble Access to become formative mm-hmm. and stay with us and accessible as we recognize patterns in our life where it might become meaningful or see another place where that art form mm-hmm. might come back out. It's poetry.
It is. And it's like, you know, one of the sections he's talking about, the dopamine response, how music stimulates the, is it the cerebellum? Am I remembering that correctly? But it does create a dopamine response. And I think that's amazing that worship engages that part of our brain, and especially music and worship, and kind of triggers that such positive response. And
yeah, or at least it can.
It can. Yeah.
So I think two things in response. One, I'll share that in the pre-show, we talked at length about my own experience of needing that dopamine at different times in my life and how music was there for me as a way of producing dopamine when either naturally I wasn't producing enough or my context was not allowing me to produce enough for whatever reason in music. I attribute music as one of the ways in which I managed to survive through some dark periods in my life because probably from a neurochemical standpoint, probably just because I was getting mm-hmm. some dopamine. But we mentioned that it can produce that because sometimes it doesn't. And how emotion is tied to our experience of music is also rooted in so many different things mm-hmm. about expectation and the culture and cultural demands might be too strong a word. Expectations is probably mm-hmm. the right word. Cultural expectations we might have of music. And so an important concept is when people come into church, let's say, and we are trying to utilize music to access all these parts of their emotional and spiritual experience to create or facilitate a transcendent experience, sometimes we make the assumption that some music is better for that than other music, or that everybody's experience of music is going to be the same. And it's just flatly not true.
Yeah.
And we probably, as a community, could be more cognizant of the way in which that functions for different people.
Well, and I think, so this goes into the chapter, My Favorite Things. And I was reading it, and I really, really started paying attention. Because, of course, one of the things that's always on my mind as the parish administrator and an unofficial director of communications, I'm always trying to phrase things in such a way to reach the unchurched. How do we make ourselves accessible and invitational? And when he's talking about how we start developing our music aesthetics, even in the womb, which I thought that whole study with the reggae, especially reggae, I was thinking you before you read it with the baby, I thought that was fantastic. But in page 232, he says, most people have formed their tastes by the age of 18 or 20.
Right.
And I think it starts to open up a conversation and discussion, and I don't think there's an answer at this point. But if, what's the percentage of the U.S. that's unchurched right now? I've got that in my
70,
head.
Maybe.
Yeah.
I can't.
But if they've never been exposed to the hymnody or all the different Agnus Deis that we sing in church, and we are inviting them to a service that they don't have that connection to that genre of music, I mean, it opens up the question. It's like, if we are truly looking to do that, how do we move forward and how do we handle that challenge?
Yeah. I like the way that Levitin draws it toward hospitality is the language that I would use. He names that safety is an important component here. Mm-hmm. So page 242, safety plays a role for a lot of us in choosing music. To a certain extent, we surrender to music when we listen to it. We allow ourselves to trust the composers and musicians with a part of our hearts and our spirits. We let the music take us somewhere outside of ourselves. Many of us feel that great music connects us to something larger than our own existence, to other people, or to God. If we value music in that way, and we want to provide an opportunity for people to open up to it, then we've got to develop a sense of trust with mm-hmm. them. If in doing the performance of music within our worship experiences, we tell them that what they want to open up to is somehow wrong and what we have is right, it's not different than saying, that the food that you enjoy is irrelevant when you come to eat dinner at our house. Mm-hmm. You're going to eat what we want to eat, and that's it. We would call that bad hospitality. We have mm-hmm. a guest over, and most of us will try to do something to help that guest be comfortable. Hospitality is a demand of Christian discipleship, mm-hmm. and it extends to our music as well. So we probably have some growth to do there, but I think if we can hold on to the importance of that in this place, the expression of that as a value will mm-hmm. increase.
On the other side, you know, safety also speaks to those who, what we're doing currently is where they're finding their
right.
their thing. That's so right. how do we bridge? Yeah. How do we...
Is there balance? Is that the idea that we bring in certain elements, that we don't mm-hmm. go past a certain threshold? Do we just say, well, the church is bigger than just this one parish, and so for people who enjoy another type of music, it goes somewhere else? In my mind, one of the things that I frequently say is, if someone comes into our life and wants to be a part of our life mm-hmm. and we ignore their preferences and needs mm-hmm. for the sake of retaining our rigidity, we've probably done the wrong thing.
So I think there's a lot to be said about how right my parents were about a lot of music things. So I will just say that my parents, you know, always instilled it with me, and I mentioned this in the previous episode, that if, you know, I was in a bad mood, you know, go listen to some classical music, you know, calm yourself down. And, you know, in a way, after reading this book, I'm like, damn, my dad was right. Go Frank. but, you know, it's powerful to have that, you know, in your life.
One of the closing chapters and closing concepts in the book that I think is related, connected to all of this in an important way, especially as we approach our understanding of church music, is the evolutionary backdrop behind our capacity as human beings to create and appreciate music. There's much to be said here. We don't need to get into all of it, and certainly we won't try to recap the entire chapter, but I want to encourage the reader and listener to consider how you were designed, so to speak, for participation in music. And that is tied to your emotional centers and tied to your memory. It's tied to your capacity to hold on to language in such a way that your whole self is participating when you participate in music. That's an incredibly important thing for us to hold on to as we try to bring our whole selves into church services. The definition of what worship is really about our expression of value, bringing our whole selves to God and giving our whole selves to God. Worship is a word that came from the root worth-ship. It's our expression of worth. If we hold back a part of our sense of worth, then we're holding back a part of our ability to worship. And so as we approach church, as we year after year make tweaks here and there, as we offer hospitality to the stranger and to our guests, as we offer hospitality in the development of music in a way that allows them to open up, and as we develop worship that allows us to open up, we've got to make sure that we give ourselves the ability to sing our love songs to mm-hmm. God.
I love the last few lines of the book, and it's on page 267. And it says, as a tool for the activation of specific thoughts, music is not as good as language. As a tool for arousing feelings and emotions, music is better than language. The combination of the two, as best exemplified in a love song, is the best courtship display of all.
It really is beautiful. He doesn't bring a lot of religion into the book, mm-hmm. but from time to time he does. And he notes somewhere else that the Old Testament is mm-hmm. filled with really liturgical song and poetry, because that was the best way to convey the story in an emotionally compelling way through time. That's absolutely true. One of the things that's consistent in the Bible as well is that the various orders of creation are all participating in music as they offer their worship to God. So even in the book of Revelation, as we see angels around the throne of God, mm-hmm. they are singing songs. Songs that, by the way, we also sing in church.
Mm-hmm.
The tune might be different. The text is the same. That's where we draw those texts from. But what a beautiful way of relaying to us information about the importance of song in the expression of our love back to God. So as we close up our read of this book and our conversation, there are a couple of things that come to mind as asks or invitations to you, the listener. One of those is that we would love to hear from you again about your takes on the book, your experience of music, especially your experience of music in church. Please leave us an email or comment on the social media posts associated with this podcast to let us know what you've learned, and then to hold, as you step away from this book, the importance of music, as we just mentioned. As a staff, certainly we have some really talented and wonderful musicians on staff, and people who are dedicated to the pursuit of music as an art form in which we express and bring our whole selves to God and in love and in praise. And some of them have designed some really great opportunities for us this fall as ways for us to experience in community that transcendent gift of the creation of music. And really, it's also just fun. So one of those is coming up in August. It's there in the second week of August. Mm-hmm. On the 11th of August, we will be hosting something of a hymn sing. We're calling it Howling at the Moon. It's a full moon that Thursday night, and we're going to gather together and sing, probably have some beverages, adult and otherwise.
The moon theme. We'll be punning off the moon theme.
Yeah. Having moon pies.
Mm-hmm. Blue moon.
Blue moon beer and equally appealing non-alcoholic beverages as well that may or may not have a moon theme. But if you're the kind of person who's already drawn into this, we want to see you there. We want to hear you there. And one of the things that I would say that is really an important lesson from this book is that that includes you who maybe have less expertise than someone else. You've still been given an instrument and a capacity to appreciate music. And so please come out and participate. It should be a really fun way for us to be together.
And if you'd like to learn a little bit more about music, Sue Wallace is actually conducting a Music 101 class starting in July.
So cool.
You can find more information about that on our website or in the Illumination. And it is a great way. It's a drop-in, drop-out class, 1 hour on Thursday evenings. And she swears she can teach you to play Amazing Grace within 5 minutes.
So very cool. So thank you for joining us again, and we look forward to joining you next week as we start our next book, Dear Justice.
So until then, go forth into the world to love and to read.